All right, gang, May and I are here, and we have a new project. No, we're trying to make this light.
As you can tell, the background sound, if you hear any dogs rustling or a computer fan whirling, that's just because we're trying to make this so that it's a little bit extra for you guys while not taking too much and putting it on our plate.
Yeah, so we've just grabbed our equipment from the Maverstation and slapped it down, and we're going to give you an impromptu podcast. We're going to hope for every episode. And then this should replace my sort of long, winding emails that sort of have no point. And we'll have a nice discussion that still has no point, but at least you get to hear our voices.
Yeah, our beautiful, sultry voices.
And I believe I'm just going to throw this up on YouTube because that's where everybody's used to watching us anyway. I'll just keep them as private videos. And
Yeah.
whenever possible, we'll try to get some visuals in there. But I'm sorry, you guys are mostly going to have a static screen. So this is really just a review of what happens between the episodes in order to get them done. And the big things that have been hanging over our head right now are a lot of travel.
Yes.
We don't normally travel that often, and I just recently had a question about when are we coming to Europe, and the answer is I have no clue how we would even do that, both in terms of expense of time and money.
Money isn't the issue because we can always fundraise and stuff like that. So that's never really been a super big problem. But the problem is the time.
Deliberately, yes, but unfortunately, we made some projections for bringing May on board that we have just fundamentally been unable to hit for 2019. 2019 was supposed to be like a 50% growth year, with an emphasis on adding additional, shows and things like that. And we've really had to kind of cut a little tighter because a lot of people aren't aware of this. When we brought May in, we lost an income stream, which was her other job, and then created more demand on the CNRSL budget. So we hit a number that we knew would float us. And then we hope to sort of grow above that by spreading show growth and a little bit of AdSense and just things here and there. We're going to chip in money and it would kind of work out okay. A lot of what YouTube has done has sort of replaced that, and so I've had to switch gearing and in the background for things that you're going to see in 2020 because it takes time to develop and have a plan that's not going to fall flat. I've been trying to develop merchandise opportunities or other ways to monetize the show, and that's kind of a big distraction. So I'm doing a lot of financial work to try to get us ready for next year so that we don't have this problem again. May has been doing a lot of cleaning up our old financial work, so that we don't end up with government issues. And then we're producing the show.
Which I've taken some of your workload off of you, and then you being you, Mr. Busybody, you're like, oh, that means that I can do more stuff.
Well, it's future proofing. There's this real fear of losing growth. So right now I'm talking to a friend who is very committed to the idea of having another show on the channel that should be very different and interesting, but I can't promise anything because he's yet to start doing that thing where you put in the hours. And putting in the hours is how stuff gets done. So we'll see. I give it a 50-50 at this point. And then I have another show that I want to launch on top of Primer, that's very visually based. It's a shotgun series. There's some pieces that we need to lay hands on before I can really say that it's a green light for this coming year. But I also have met a friend. There's a small YouTube channel called Phoenix Fart. And fart is spelled with a PH. I wish I was kidding. And I bumped into him because, and this will help you find it, I was looking up the Walther Toggle-Lock Shotgun. And this is a guy who actually lives in my state. We met because we started talking about the Walther Toggle Lock Shotgun. And I love the guy, great dude. And he has a really good eye for getting nice angles on
Yeah, and he
things.
was just doing this by himself. That's the part that amazes me because I've been watching his videos, for months before that, and the fact that he is just doing that all by himself is incredible because I know how much it takes for us to get set up, and the fact that he can get it in focus and it's beautiful. He does a great job.
Phoenix is, he's probably my favorite video creator in this funny niche way because when we started CNRSL, if you watch the first episodes, you can tell that's what I wanted to do was to get in and intimate on the guns and get some movement in there and follow and track. And we ran out of time. Like, especially with me being the only full-time person, there was no way. And now with May full-time, we should have had that option, but I've had to turn a lot of my attention to other things.
And then I've been cleaning up some backlog stuff essentially, so.
So we're trying to get in a position where we'll have the help in 2020 to really start doing more movement and more intimacy on the filming of the pieces. And then try to translate that from the Shotgun series back into Primer. So the Shotgun series is hopefully going to be sort of a test bed to get us better understanding of how to do Primer, because when we leave World War One, we lose a lot of our public domain material,
right?
And therefore we don't have the visuals. So that's something that is on my mind right now, and we're a year ahead of that happening. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be, because I have to be ready for that transition, or it's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on sort of in the meta game. And then in the more direct episodic content is that we took 3 range sessions to get 1 range session's worth of video.
So it's like anything that could have gone wrong. So it was like weather at one point, and then it was gun malfunction at one point, and then it was people showing up to the range, which that can invariably happen at being a...
Yeah, so what happens is we will reserve a day, and if that messes up, then we kind of have to... We don't want to... It's a semi-private range.
Yeah.
Well, it is a privately owned range with a club, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's there hardly during the day and the weekdays, but somebody might show up, and we need to yield the range if that happens.
Absolutely.
So what we do is we reserve a day a month to get our filming done. And those days are ours.
Yep.
And if something goes wrong on those days... Well, then we're kind of like having to do the minefield dance. We have to get into the range and hope nobody shows up. And then, of course, somebody does show up. So that sort of cascade happened to us this last time around. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but depending on traffic and other things, it can be, you know, a 2-hour round trip to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be an hour and a half or hour 20.
But it just realistically depends. And then on top of that, like, it, sometimes they're good about it. We've had people show up and, you know, if we have something especially neat or they're just right. wanting to observe, they've been good about it. But then, you know, if someone shows up, we definitely don't want to be those kinds of people that just kick them off or, like, end up taking up their time because...
Well, you don't want to interrupt another business's operation.
Right, exactly.
So, we have to be, you know, you can't, we don't have a dedicated space is no. the short answer. We don't own our own. We are very small. So, while we're dancing the range, we also have had a couple travel things that have come up recently. So we went out to Wyoming, which was a very long trip and took up a lot of our potential catch-up time. And that put us back on a just-in-time schedule. And then on top of that, while I was out there, I was talking to Ian, and he said he had gotten a hold of Villa Ferosa. That was an opportunity I couldn't say no to. So we rushed to do that, and it doesn't sound like a lot to take two days to get up and down to Pennsylvania and then like half a day to process what we got.
Right.
But in our schedule where it's a documentary every other week, we're running the wire pretty tight.
Mm-hmm. And like basically those are I would say 8-hour days, but it's more like 10 to 12 depending on the work load we try to load ourselves up with.
If you think about this, two of us, and we both work a minimum of 12 hours a day. So that's 24 hours and then 2 days of it, 48. And then even just a half day next, let's say that gets us up, what, to 60 hours?
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. You've lost 60 man hours. So that's like a week and a half of normal labor.
Mm-hmm.
Just to take 2 days. Because we work 7 days a week. Like it just, there's no day off at CN Arsenal right now.
No, not really. Well, to be fair, we're also trying to clean up some backlog and stuff like that. So we're doing backlog. We're trying to make sure that we're doing normal episode production while pulling ahead.
Yeah, I have a lot of orphan projects. Like, just stuff that we couldn't keep up. Like people are excited about the book. The book hasn't had any work done on it in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing. Because there's just no time. And then even more than that, like, I was doing those image sets. There's been no photography practically for 2 years because other than what's come in for episodes, but there's been no extra photography, no photography trips.
Right.
Because there's just, where's the time?
And so we're hoping to get ahead in episodes so that we can build the time for that. It just so happens that what we were doing was getting ahead on episodes or getting just up to the line on the episode and then going for this trip to Wyoming or Pennsylvania right. or even what we just
And those are necessary because you want to stay plugged into... So, like, Wyoming was the museum trip.
Mm-hmm.
So we went out to Cody and we met with a lot of other people who are in arms preservation and we had a good time. But more importantly, we built or rebuilt connections... to people who have access that we will need to do something like the book or to find research materials. And, you know, you get a little bit better buy-in from them. You get them to understand what it is that you're doing and how you're doing it. And you also try to find ways that something like CN Arsenal that has an audience can benefit them. And
right.
that's something I'm still trying to figure out. It varies from museum to museum, but I would really like to build an audience that is responsive not just to video, but is responsive to books, text articles, that is responsive to calls for help or donations to museum collections because they need to be protected. I would like to have, I don't want to say activist community because it sounds so negative, but I mean like a community that is invested in historical arms who wants to be clear that they want these things preserved and taken care of and researched and understood.
Mm-hmm.
And to that effect, by the way, if you're curious, there is a currently, right now, Surplus is up. It's an alpha site that I've made in which I'm hoping to try to sort of aggregate different types of media that all talk about old guns. And that's just surplus.com with one S. So surplused.com. You guys can go poke it. It's not really meant for public consumption yet. I mean, it is out there, but yeah, give it a kick. Let me know what you think. It's kind of cool. But, so that's another side project that I'm working on. So, the point we're getting to, though, is that we're kind of, we're behind the gun.
We're trying to look for avenues of growth and also making sure that we clean up some of the mess that, unfortunately, Othias just wasn't able to tackle because he was the only one solely working on CN Arsenal for a while. So, effectively, we're trying to grow while making sure what we currently have looks a little bit tidier.
Right. And so, that means a lot of hours, is the short answer.
And we're willing to put it in.
Well, yes, but we're also very inflexible.
True.
And we're not pulling ahead yet on production. And so, when we agreed to do, you know, Cody, Wyoming, and then run out the Villa Pros, and we already agreed to go see our friends over at IV88 shoot, we started to get tight on schedule. So that was a very long story to get to the point of we came into this week screaming hot because you and I were filming the episode that you guys are watching by the time this releases. We were filming that, like, the same week it's being released.
Yep.
We're filming the outdoor footage the same way it's being released. That is awful. I hate being in that situation.
It's because you're basically, you're just hoping that, oh God, I hope the weather holds out or, you know, everything works out fine because it's to the wire at that point.
Yeah,
it's always unsettling.
We did a 48-hour mega edit on this episode so that we could have it ready before we went out to the IV88 shoot. And then it's compiling now as we're doing this. And then I hate that because it means that I list it to YouTube the same day it goes out. And YouTube loves to play this game of not demonetizing us until there's 1,000 views in.
Yep.
So, like, we get 1,000 views in, boom, demonetized. Everybody watches the episode. 2 weeks later, they remonetize it. Nobody watches it.
Yep.
It's every time. So the best part about YouTube is, like, they keep repeatedly saying that we're safe for monetization on the primer series. Anvil's completely demonetized. But they'll say, oh, yeah, you're safe for monetization just as soon as everybody's watched it. Like, it's just nuts.
It is insane.
So, basically, all the money we make on AdSense right now is the back catalog slowly being watched by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more views. If we got monetization money for all of our views when the episodes were released, we would triple our money.
Oh, yeah. Easily.
But we never... it's like magic. I mean, I'm a little paranoid about it because it's maybe one episode in five that it just is monetized throughout that peak.
Right.
Every episode gets demonetized. Every single one will hit the yellow dollar. It's just when and, you know, at what critical moment.
Mm-hmm.
I say 2 weeks, but really it's usually only about 5 days
to get them remonetized. Yeah, it's about 5 days, but unfortunately that's like the core viewership that tends to happen.
The trench gun episode that did so well, I was so paranoid about this that I repackaged and re-released our grenade throw thing because I was like, at least this doubles my chances of having one of them monetized. And I was a little proud of myself because that worked. They demonetized the trench gun video. It went through review. It went to email. It went through review. And then I've never had this before. I got an email back that said, hey, we're still reviewing this. And I was like, this is weird.
Really? Yeah. I've never actually heard of that.
And then another week went by, and it's, hey, we're still reviewing it. It took 2.5 weeks for that thing to be monetized. Everybody's done watching it.
Right.
But I had put out, you know, shortly after that grenade throw one, and that took a lot of attention, and it stayed, for whatever reason, it stayed monetized. That one has saved our buns. Like, mm-hmm. Because that gave us a little bit of extra cash injection, and it's letting us eke by this month. So that was good.
Nice.
And we're kind of in a penny counting phase because disproportionately we're consuming funds because we're preparing for a show
mm-hmm.
that we're not putting out yet. So eventually we will hopefully make something off that show, but it's not there yet. So we're kind of eating a loss to get geared up.
Right, but this is actually, I think this is, you're probably pretty happy with this, because unlike with what you could do with the Primer series, you're trying to accumulate all the pieces and all the elements before.
Yeah, we're talking about the Shotgun series now, yeah. Which keeps changing shape, by the way. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like yet, but this is a good time to talk about this. Hold on, let me get us back on rails here. So we did all this work to get ready to go out of town, to go see Ivy 8088. And then we went to the happiest place on earth. And where is that, May?
Thomasville. That was amazing.
So we were already going to have to go to the other side of Georgia, down through the southern section of Georgia. And I don't know if you guys have ever tried to travel east or west in southern Georgia, but there's no roads for that. So you just drive through little
farm towns. Try to go during the day so that you can actually appreciate some of the weird little towns you
pass. Oh, they're beautiful there. Little towns. Oh, yeah.
It's just at night, they're just... they're empty and so desolate, and you can't see around you, so it doesn't look like anything. But during the day, they have some bizarre names on buildings. One of them was, like, what, a peacock town? Like, that was
weird.
Yeah,
there's a lot of interesting towns down there, and they all have their little thing going on. Like, one was into murals, and one was into peacocks, and one was into... and they're just different, and it's actually a nice drive in the day, but at night coming back was a nightmare. Because it's just suicidal deer attacks from all directions.
Yeah, they make eye contact, too.
I don't know if
that's
any of you guys live
part.
In the rural areas, but you see those eyes shining in the dark, and you're like, here come the brakes.
Yeah, so. It's like, I know what you're about to do. I can tell.
I keep thinking of the Louis C.K. sketch, but I can't say that here. So, we're going through, small towns in Georgia in the daylight, which is nice, because mm-hmm. we get to look around and see all the independently owned this and that, and, you know, there's a lot of berry growers and fruit growers, and then a lot of cotton fields.
That was really pretty.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It's just also kind of slow going, but we decided to take an hour or 20 detour, because there's this website called Kevin's Catalog, and if you go there, because I just said this... and if you happen to buy something, for God's sake, tell them that I sent you there, because I would like them to know we exist. We're a military history show, and it's kind of hard to tell someone else, like, we're going to be doing sporting shotguns. Would you like to be a part of that? But I wanted to get down there and make contact. So we got down there, we met the man who manages their actual gun department. Wonderful person named Brock. Everybody give him a compliment for being a gracious host. But... the place is beautiful.
Now, it's amazing.
We went to Thomasville one. There's one down in, I believe, Tallahassee.
Florida? Yeah.
And I haven't been down there. But where we went was just gorgeous. And also, there's cool taxidermists around the corner. So it was a great double experience. But it's like a high-end English shotgun outfitter just in the middle of the Deep South. And everything was beautiful.
The colors in there were just phenomenal.
Right. It was well curated. Obviously, the prices are kind of high because it's actual sporting clothing. And I know I've had this conversation with some people because I'm not a wealthy man. I don't have wealthy friends. And you show them a jacket that costs $250 and they flinch. And the problem, though, is then you have to go, well, this one won't fall apart after two seasons. Like, this is a 10-year jacket easy.
Right, this is one that I'm not going to be replacing anytime soon.
Right, it's traditionally waterproofed, and it has actual box-cut shoulders, or an actual pleat cut, or something like that.
Right.
And you go, look, just take your $30 whatever off and put this on. Or even not even if it's $30, sometimes it's some of the nicer stuff, but it's made by a company that doesn't understand shooting.
Right, so it'll feel fine, but then you go to raise your arms and you start pulling at the shoulders. Well, that's not going to be useful.
Especially women.
Yes.
May has struggled to find anything that leaves her freedom of movement. And so when she can find women's clothiers who are not just aping the style of European shooting clothing, but actually is...
but have the true cuts that I need to actually flex my shoulders. That's phenomenal. And it's honestly always been incredibly hard just shopping in general, because I've got a nice wide shoulder set, so finding something that I can raise up with a firearm has always been a little bit of trying.
Yeah,
here, it was
well,
everywhere galore.
The women's section was just about as big as the men's.
Yes, that was probably the first time I've ever seen that.
And it wasn't, you would imagine, I know a lot of you guys are imagining this, you're like, okay, they have a couple women's shootings, jackets, and shirts, and then the rest of it's sort of this frilly stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. They did have some, you know, dressier, sporting-inspired shirts, as far as you could tell, when you tried them all, they all still let you roll your shoulders. They all still let you move.
There was only, I think, maybe like one particular brand that it seemed to have a little bit of a tightness on it. But other than that, the most of them, it was just comfort. Like, I could basically have handled shotguns no problem all day in those. And my favorite part was some of them had the pads on them, and you could actually change out the padding on the inside if you wanted to on
that's
the shirts.
That was
great. Fantastic
stuff. And as much as it was quote-unquote pricey, it was cheaper than I expected. Like, for this kind of stuff, having had to buy it before, I spent less than I thought I would. So I would recommend them. And this is, by the way, I haven't been solicited to say this, and we're obviously just in a little personal podcasty thing right now. But
no, but essentially this was like you went there for inspiration for the shotgun series.
Right. If you're the kind of person who's frustrated, I would say go check this out. I did notice, by the way, men, if you're about to order from the catalog, and I don't know if this is across the board, I tried on a couple things. Where I would normally be a 2X, I was a XL. Where I was normally an XL, I was a large. Everything felt like it was a one size oversized.
Yeah, for you.
So bring your size down one. I can't guarantee that, but that's where I would guess if you're going to order from a catalog without being able to try it on.
And
I hope that helps.
If you're ordering for, if there are any women ordering potentially for that, the sizes just ran normal. They actually, some of them, even just small, medium, larges, or even if they had the sizes themselves, like 6, 8, 10, 12, whatever, they were pretty spot on for accuracy for measurements on those. So don't worry about that.
Yeah. And I also love that they left you the shoulder room. So May has the broadest shoulders, so we tend to... We tend to get her up a size on a shirt to give her the shoulder room, and then...
We have to tailor in the center because my stomach doesn't quite match that.
Yeah, we have to send them over to a tailor and just get them adjusted. Like, that's very common for May's outfits. So, it was nice to be able to just buy you clothes. It was fantastic.
I just bought them and they fit, and I went, this is, like, my happy place right now.
Yeah. So, they had the clothing. They also had a lot of trappings. They had cases and accessories, and I know this sounds really boring and crazy, but when you're trying to build a show... And you want to have May look a certain way, and you want to have the background a certain way, and you really, because this shotgun series, I really want to try to sell an experience. I want to try to sell the experience of using that shotgun. And sort of put people in a mindset of vintage. Like, just something that looks relaxing, that looks pleasant, you know? And feels pleasant, almost like an ASMR.
You know the amount of elements that you have to culminate to kind of create that almost taste of the show is going to be, every element needs to go together too. It can't just be you slap a bunch of things down on a table. No, there's got to be a flow to it.
It also has to be suitably generic because the mission of the show is the repeating shotgun in chronological order. So center fire repeating shotguns. That means pump, lever, semi-automatic, whatever.
Right.
But no double barrels, none of that. So we're not going to do this hard English theme. We're not going to do this Deep South theme, because it's not all Dixie. You could say it's sort of a New England or Midwest thing. The American shotgun tends to be... There are repeating shotguns that are not American, but repeating shotguns tend to be a very American thing. So at best, you could have a generic Americana, but their influence is pretty widespread, and it's just inherently kind of rural. And that's about all you can get out of it. So we have to be... It's interesting to see what we can find that does not overly put us in one camp or another for visuals. And that kind of gives us the color and the feel and that breadth of what we want to express. And being able to have a physical environment that I can walk into and be like, okay, this feels right. Like, this feels like the kind of thing that can be built intentionally and marketed. And I don't want it to sound synthetic, but... You do have to make it in order to film it.
You're trying to create an atmosphere.
Right.
Which isn't something that, if an element is out of place, it breaks the atmosphere.
Yeah. And I'm not a designer. And we don't have one on staff. So I'm trying to get... It's like me learning Photoshop or me learning animation or me learning whatever to do the show. I'm trying to learn design in a new way in order to build another show.
Right.
So we went to Thomasville and we had a lot of fun with that. So if you get the chance, check out Kevin's catalog, especially if you can get to, I think it's called Kevin's Outfitters,
but yes,
it's the actual physical store.
That's the physical store.
Yeah. If you're in that area, or down near Tallahassee, I guess they have another location, by all means, check them out. Like, if you buy anything, please tell them that we sent you, because that would just, I'd love to be able to work more directly with them. By the way, if anybody is... Has any knowledge of anybody that produces clays or shotgun shells? Like, if you work at Federal or something, or you know somebody who does, I always want to know who to talk to, because when we do something like this, we're going to be consuming materials that people can actually buy and interact with, and it's our first chance to actually bring in sponsors, because there's not really a way to sponsor World War I firearms, because the ammo's obsolete, the guns are obsolete, nobody's right. building, or there's nothing to market, you know what I mean? But when you talk about old shotguns, well, you know, there's loaders like RST that do, you know, 2.5-inch shells. Maybe they'd be interested in working with us, although they haven't responded to my emails. You know, maybe like some like White Flyer would be interested, although they haven't responded to my emails, or Federal might be interested, although they haven't responded to my social media messages. So maybe if some of their customers were to send them some notes that they might want to get involved. But it's just about trying to reach out to people, and right now it's kind of a black hole getting anything back from the sort of companies that we would want to work with.
Right. It kind of seems like, as big as they are, having a connection to someone that is there, someone that even just hearing from other people, hey, just so you know, these people are looking to potentially help market your product.
I don't think they always have a category for us. So they get the email in, and their job is to sort of just, they get these
filter through, and I'm sure they get a constant stream of them.
And there's probably a ton of people trying to get money out of them or whatever involvement, and they don't know what's good and what's bad. And I'm not even trying to be bitter. It's just, I just don't think they can parse. And a lot of people are probably writing emails trying to get gimmies. And it's just right. like, well, yes, this is a gimme, but it's also like, I really, really think I can get
Well, I mean, like, even like when we had that partnership that we did with Brownells for the Project Lightning setup, we definitely tried to market them as much as possible. They didn't ask for it. Oh, that was the best part. Like, they didn't ask for it at all, but we went, oh, no, you helped us out with this project. We are definitely making sure to put your name on this, so...
So from the old gun shop, we went over to the Ivy 8088 shoot, and
yes.
I think that's a good segue to talk about Brownells, actually, because yeah. we saw Roy over there.
Nice hats.
And you got to try out one of their retro rifles, and I know we have video for that, so we can actually light up the screen here for anybody that's switched over to audio listening, and they can scope you out with one of their retros, and then they actually had fitted it with the new scope that they've come out with, and that thing was pretty sweet. You were slapping the paddle with it in that rain.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was fantastic. Hitting out to, like, 250 yards, like, that was amazing.
Yeah, beautiful little gun. Although, as you could probably tell, the fact that it doesn't have a deflector means every single case went straight into the camera. But May seemed to enjoy herself, and that's all that matters. So irritate your friends from safely behind the line with your retro AR pattern rifle. Oh, I love those guns, though. I mean, I'm glad they're making money on it, because we went out to Brownells, and we met Paul, who's been behind a lot of this.
Yes.
And great dude, really interested in getting it right.
I love that whenever we meet other people and they're like, no, this isn't done until it's correct.
Yeah, I mean, there are some differences, but there's limitations to manufacturing, there's limitations to what they had in their hands at that time. And they went through, I would actually love to see them... I might talk to them about that, about trying to get down and, like, interview Paul and talk about building those retro rifles. Let's see if we can do that.
Okay, yeah.
Because...
We planned on making another trip out there anyway, because the facility was phenomenal.
Yeah, he was sitting down talking to me, and it was so fascinating, the lengths he had to go through to get what he needed to even start that project. And the fact that they backed him on that is just... I don't know how to explain how different Brownells is from other companies in terms of being willing to go that extra step... to do what's cool.
Like, yeah.
Not cool as in... Not thing of the week.
Right.
Not reactive cool. But no. Actually sustainably cool.
Right. Like, fundamentally cool.
Yeah. Doing it the right way. Doing it the interesting way. And being willing to do things that the market wants.
And to go the extra mile that wasn't necessarily easy on them. It wasn't just a little quick thing that he was able to do. No, he took the time with that.
They put a lot of extra expense in that where I don't think other companies would have. Like, right. The work they did on it was the kind of work a hobbyist would want to do on it.
Mm-hmm.
The obsessive. And I know that there's going to be people, especially in our audience, that are like, yeah, but this thing's not quite there. Or this thing's not... And it's like, yeah, they didn't have that in front of them at that time. There are limitations. They do have to manufacture. They do have to make money. However, you're hard. Who else is even remotely this close to doing something this cool?
I would like to know if there are other companies that are doing anything remotely close to that. But to my knowledge, there aren't.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So, A+ Brownells, always.
Yeah.
Unless something radically shifts, trust your money there, because they take they take you, the consumer, very seriously.
Yes. They value your opinions and your critiques.
Yeah, and they're very much behind the culture and the community.
Yeah, and they're a massive company. That's the best part, is they're a huge, massive company, and yet they still value the little person.
Yeah, and they haven't lost sight of what their community is. You know what I mean? It's fantastic. So, and I'm not they haven't sold me on any of that. By the way, they've applied zero sales pressure to me in our entire interaction. They just show me the stuff they have. They talk about how passionate they are about it a little bit. You know, they're just like, oh, we really like this because Paul did this. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. And you just, you're drawn in. They don't come out and grab you. You know what I mean? They just let you in the door. And I love that about them. So we saw Barnells. But what else did we do? We there's the guys over at Escort Shotguns. We kind of set up near them in Crazy Quail.
Yep.
And brought some old shotguns to try out with our buddy Kevin. And honestly, at one point, I guess the machines ran out of clays.
Yeah.
And they weren't sure about resetting them. I don't know what happened, but the machine stalled out for like 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And people were kind of standing around with shotguns that they wanted to test.
Yeah.
Some
were just trying to just at least test them in the air without any clays, and that was just kind of sad.
Yeah, so we were like, oh, okay, we got this. So we ended up backing the truck up and pulling the...
DuPont.
Yeah, we had a clay hand thrower from like 1902 was the patent date. I want to say...
was it 1903 or 1902?
I want to say J.C. Mitchell. It's early 1900s. A man named Mitchell came up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was sold through like J.C. I can't remember now. DuPont bought it out though a few years later.
Right.
So then it became the DuPont hand trap, which is the one we have. So it's probably made around 1910.
It's a terrifying little thing. It's got a garage door spring on it.
It's a cast iron skin flayer with a trampling spring on it. I mean, this thing wouldn't pass any sort of inspection.
No.
But it throws
them.
So I thought it threw terribly when we tested it here, but I just hadn't gotten the rhythm yet. I knew to sort of thrust it. I knew to sort of play with it. But honestly, I think Kevin got it.
Kevin managed to actually just be the one to
and
hit a rhythm.
Kevin, by the
it.
Way, you can see him. I don't remember. We've done a couple takes now, and I forgot. Kevin he's part of IV88's crew-ish. Like, he's in that family. Although we keep trying to poach him if we can get him to move here. And he is a great
boy.
He's
a delight.
You can see him in some of IV88's videos on Black Powder. Like, he'll turn up in those a lot.
Yeah.
But he's one of my best friends. And so Ken was hanging out with us having a hoot, but he got a hold of that thrower and got it figured out faster than anybody else.
Oh, yeah. It was honestly just like watching him just like try to bayonet thrust effectively into the air, and he just managed to get the arc just right. So
but then
he,
from there, the rest of us kind of figured it out. And
yeah.
We were throwing pretty good with that thing.
Oh,
I threw better than I realized.
Right. Yeah.
So
Heavy. It's just heavy after a while because it's just like all steel or iron.
Oh well, the advertising for the air is great. I'd have to go look at it to be sure, but like there's all these advertising where it's just like, you gotta understand. Back then, it was like those giant cast iron expert traps. Remington bought those out. I can't think of who owned them before, but the cast iron expert was like the most popular trap throwing device from like 1890 to 1930 or 40. It had a really long life, and what it was just a string operated, manually operated, and they just put somebody behind a piece of wood in the middle of a field,
mm-hmm.
and you'd pay kids quarters or whatever, and they would just run those all day downrange for you, and you just call out to the kids to run the traps, and those were big and heavy and expensive, and so they came up with the hand trap, which is the same cocking arm, just mounted to like a pistol grip and a foregrip.
Yep.
With a wire trigger, and you just... The advertising on them is amazing. I mean, it just...
I would not want to get smacked by one of those.
You can do the art of trap shooting anywhere you want, at any time, out in the fields with your friends and blah, blah, blah. And it's so handy, weighing in at only 9 pounds.
<It's> like,
holy
what?
Crap. Yeah, it's only like 8 or 9 pounds. That's it. Give it to women and children and let them just throw this trampoline spring-powered monstrosity.
Meanwhile, the thing is terrifying because you got to cock the arm, so it's like pulling against this massive garage door spring that's just like terrifying looking, and it latches into place, and you're like, well, God, I hope this doesn't go off at any moment.
My favorite is that only like a quarter of the latch locks, and that's how it's designed.
So you're looking at it, you're being like, is that... is that enough? Is that going to hold it?
Yeah, you're like at least you have like
this moment of panic.
Like, at first you're like, oh good, it's like an inch wide tab. And then you realize that only like 3 centimeters lock. And you're like, ugh. So, but we were using it because we're idiots. And we were throwing them just fine. And everybody managed to keep shooting. And we had a little bit of fun there. But,
but that first day, it was just raining so bad that a lot of people were just staying under whatever tent that they managed to secure.
Yeah, so they did a new thing this year. They spread everything out a little bit. But everything turned to mud and rain. And nobody wanted to transition the spaces. So if you were at the 1,000-yard range, you stayed at the 1,000-yard range the whole day.
Pretty much.
And so we tried to do some wandering, but it was just so arduous to get around. We mostly hung out out in the shotguns with practically nobody else. And then the next day was much brighter, way more fun. We got to see the guys over at Microtech. They have a new suppressor that's coming out, well, now next year, because they got a big contract like right before this event. And so they're stuck on that for like 10 to 12 months. But it was a really cool little suppressor setup. And then I have a gun that I've made that I call my spike gun. And it's just a sub 2000. And this is all because Taylor, who owns CNS Shooting Sports, he was in his shop. And he, I looked up at the wall and I saw a multi-mag sub 2000. And I said, oh, is that the multi-mag? Because I was curious about how that mag well really does, which is pretty poorly.
And he just got this look on his face. Could tell he was already, he got upset. He just started at you. He was like, I swear, if that is the first modern gun you end up buying...
He used a lot more expletives.
Yes, he did. I'm being much
but
more
he
polite
threatened
about that.
To kick me in the dick if I bought that thing. So I went home and bought one.
Immediately.
Yeah, I went online. I wanted the green one.
Like, not even like 5 hours later.
Yeah. So I bought a green one, and when I got in, I was like, now how can I got to do something to make this work. So I was like, I'm going to make him want one. And so over the course of a few months, whatever pennies I could get, I would just sort of put my spare funds into tuning this thing up, and I just put every combination of stuff I could find. I went to M Carbo, Red Lion, and Midwest Industries.
Yes.
And combined parts from all three, and then the big one, and I'm going to tell you guys my little secret. Is that the Midwest Industries mount, for those of you who aren't familiar, it rotates over, and then the charging handle, since it's a slap-off charging handle, can strike the lens of whatever optic you have, well, it'll smash it. So the Midwest Industry gives you a piece of paracord that you're supposed to tie off the charging handle as a safety.
Yeah, to
but
the rear,
everybody
but...
hates that, because then it's really hard to get that string off, and it's
process. It's super annoying, yeah.
Right. And so I got mine in, and I went, well, I don't know what everybody else is doing, because I know what to do here. I just took out the Dremel, and I cut a safety channel instead of the slap-off notch.
Into
like
the receiver,
like a submachine
too.
Gun, because the MP18 and all the other submachine guns we deal with, you just make another channel.
So some people like the slap-off, and they just deal with the paracord, but if you're tired of doing that, you could just take a Dremel out.
So everybody's handled the sub 2000, I'll hand it to them, and they go slap the charging handle off, and I'm like, no, you have to draw it back. And it's just a little bit. It's just a little, like, not even a quarter.
Well, you did a two-finger grip on that charging handle, which made it much easier.
Right, so I put a two-finger grip on it, pull that thing back, and release. Just a little, just a eek. And it's enough that it will never hit the optic when it's folded.
Yep.
It still runs just fine, and it's a way simpler solution than a piece of
string. So effectively, you can put it away in your backpack without having to worry about your optic all the time.
Yeah, you know, for my self-defense with a sub 2000. So, and by the way, I get crap for this gun, but it's a toy.
Everyone's loved it.
Well,
that's
so
the best part.
I put this whole thing together, and I showed it. I took it to with me to Pennsylvania. I showed it to Ian just to piss him off, and he's just like, "Why do you have this?" And so I handed it to him. And I told him what all I did to it, and he's like, "You spent how much on a sub 2000?" I was like, "I know it's terrible, but just try the gun now, because you get trigger kit and all this other stuff, and aluminum everything, and what was aluminum steel. You get the idea. I put a ton of stuff in this gun, and." I'll put a parts list up. I'll put the link to it because I have a stupid fake write-up about it. So he plays with it for a little bit dry. He didn't get to shoot it. And he's like, you know what? Screw it. I'd run a two-gun match in it. Like, he's like, this is fun. Like, he's like, I wouldn't bet my life on it, but it's fun. And I was like, well, no. It's not a survival. It's not a defense thing.
No.
I guess you could theoretically use it as a survival thing.
It's mostly just for shits and giggles.
Yeah. But it's super fun. It's pleasant to shoot.
Taylor liked it.
And that's the thing. So this is the crowning glory, is that I show this to Taylor, and he goes, he begrudgingly admits it's not as bad as it was. Like, he's like, this is about as good as you could push this.
Yeah, he was doing that thing where he was just like,
And then later on, he had gotten 10 beers in while we were hanging out somewhere else. And we're just sitting around talking. And we're talking about that gun again. And he's a little more positive about it. And then I got my victory a little bit after that because his wife told me that he had been around her going, "Hey, didn't you want one of the Sub 2000? And she goes, "No, I've never wanted one. I can't remember what it was." And he goes, "I'm pretty sure you wanted one, right?" And she's just like, "No, and if you try to buy one and blame it on me, I will deny it."
So she's like, "I will tattle."
He was trying to use the wife to sneak one in so that he could build his own. So my spike gun had exactly the desired effect, which to me is just, it's
worth it. You're so happy. You're so happy.
It is my pride and joy now because I've converted
Taylor. He shows it to everybody. He took it with us the IV-88 shoot.
So yeah, okay, so I took it there, and yeah. I'm walking around with this little thing. Everybody wanted to shoot it. Like, I'm sorry, nobody had one. Right? And yeah. They would do, "Oh, sub 2000. I'd be like, "Yeah, I put way too much." I would just literally say, I'd be like, "Yeah, you want to make a $300 gun into an $1,100 gun? Here you go." And they'd be like, "Well, what'd you do to it?"
Yeah.
And so you tell them, and they kind of roll their eyes and they mock you, but they're going to shoot it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's 9mm. It's right there.
So every one of them shot it, and afterwards, every one of them had a smile, and they're just like, "Oh, that's pretty good, but it's still good." Like, it's a moped. Like, everybody rolls their eyes at it, but once they're on it, they're enjoying themselves just fine. Like, it's fun. It's fun to have a moped.
Well, yeah. My favorite was is that you actually, you threw one of those Microtech suppressors on it.
Okay, so yeah, that brings us back around. So Microtech has, I think the MSRP on these suppressors is like $1,400. And I don't have that, but if I put away $100 a month for the next year, and then they finally release them a year later, maybe I'll be able to afford it. I'm thinking about trying to find my money for this. They have these like, it's like 2/3 of the suppressor and then another third. And so I was interested in the 2/3 because what it is you have a whole suppressor, but you can take a third off to get it a little shorter. It's not as quiet that way, but the sub 2000s are already weirdly quiet. So we tried it with just the 2/3 section, which was very short enough that I could mount it somehow to the gun while compact.
Right.
So
you could have it folded up with it on there and right. Not sticking out too far.
So
it still fit in your backpack.
Right. And so I shoved that thing on there, and it was so gloriously beautiful. And the funny thing is, it's like 8 or 9 people like kind of shoot that. Like, so yeah. Microtech's sitting there, and they've got some interest. But, you know, there's a bunch of pistols and a bunch of suppressors out there. And people see this little sub 2000 with the suppressor. And so there's like a handful of people that are just like, "Oh, I really want to shoot that now."
We're just here for
that. Sounds great. That's why
we're trying to pump it out. Now this is the second version, right?
Right. And the original did everything you just saw there, but the extra
it sounds great.
Look, Mom, a solid steel kill.
And so, like, the little moped won again. You know what I mean? My spite moped.
You're so happy with your spite moped.
Everybody loves my spite moped. I'm sorry. People forget to have fun sometimes. I think they take themselves too seriously. So,
Oh, yeah, you're then the one saying that. Uh-huh, Mr.
David, yeah. Who is our RO, and Triana Protection is his company.
Him has, and his wife's, yeah.
Yes. He had brought some stens, and one of his stens is threaded.
And he's, by the way, the type of person that when he starts a collection of stens, he's not going to finish it until he has all of the stens.
So many stens.
He has all the stens.
David, you have an SOT. And you just end up with a bunch of stens and nothing
else. He was
else.
So happy. So he completed the collection. He got the Charizard.
No, because he's working on Sterling. So he had a threaded sten, and he brought that over to Microtech. He's like, "Hey, can I borrow one of your suppressors to try out on my sten? I'm looking for like what I really want to put on this." And so he starts running a sten with a suppressor, and we're on a line with machine guns. I mean, there's been machine guns for 2 days going mm-hmm. on this line, and suppressed machine guns. And he opens up with that, and half of the people around us stop what they're doing and turn around.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave and I were talking about later, and a lot of it was that the fire rate is just so different.
Yes.
And the sound is so different because you hear all this metal, and you hear, it's interesting, but a suppressed sten sounds more interesting than other guns suppressed because it's such a low cyclic rate with a lot of clinking metal and that slap of the open bolt and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks really weird.
Look at
So people flocked to that thing.
It was amazing.
There's Instagram pictures and videos galore of that thing.
Yeah.
And Microtech had gone, like, they were like, we need to do something. Because we
should have brought some automatics with this. It wasn't just because it was an automatic. It was because it was a Sten.
Like, right. With automatics, and you would walk right past them.
That was that weird factor of, like, this is unique and different, and then they slapped a suppressor on it. What the heck is going on with that?
It's also kind of more pleasant. Like, there's that element of just... Yeah, sorry, you're checking your mic. I'll check, too. Yeah, okay, we're good. So, there's that element of the low fire rate being more pleasant to shoot. Mm-hmm. You get a little more enjoyment out of it. You get 30 rounds of 9mm on some PDW-style thing that just rips it through it. Your enjoyment is done.
Yeah, it's very instantaneous. This is one that, like, you can actually... have a few seconds of enjoyment, which is nice.
30 rounds on the stand, you just duck, 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 and you get to hit a couple targets, you get to sweep around a little bit, you know, like, it's a better experience, I think.
Oh, yeah, it's a blast.
So, a lot of fun. I mean, there's other little encounters.
Double Dog let me try out some, shooting some of their guns. I got to shoot out to 1,000 yards, which was fantastic. Like, they really helped to...
Yeah, we don't have the range for that here.
No.
Like, we don't get to do any real long-range shooting, and you're training up because we're hoping to do a special on sniper rifles at some point. So, what'd you play with out there?
Yeah, I'm absolutely terrible about remembering all the names of all the companies that I got to try, because I'm not going to lie, I got to try a lot of them. But we did actually do some good video segments with them, so we'll throw them up on Instagram.
Yeah, you were calling them out with David. He's currently uploading them for me, and I'm going to try to get them over to Instagram, I guess, is the place to do that, because we don't really have a modern channel.
Yeah, that'd probably be the best place to show it. But I got to try out for 600, 800, and then 1,000 yards. And I honestly got to sight in a few of them, which was fantastic training for me, because I've never done that before. It's never been my experience. So the first day... I only really shot a 600, and it was pouring down rain. So the range was just hazy out there. So I got to try shooting through that. And then the next day, it was boiling hot. So that meant that, of course, the water was evaporating, creating a nice little wavy mirage down the range. So that was fun to kind of try through. But, no, it was great. Everyone was very accommodating and letting us try anything and everything we wanted to shoot.
I was not with you on the 1,000-yard, but I came back by a little bit later, and a few people talked to me. And the consensus I got... was that you wandered out there and took a couple, you know, trying shots, I guess. Like, you took a couple, like, plinks just to see where things were hitting. And from what I was told is you were ringing steel extremely fast.
Well, apparently people were bragging about me, but I don't think I was ringing them that fast. I think I'm still very much learning in this process.
I was told that you were putting Dave to shame.
Keeping
up to with him. I heard that you're hitting every shot that he was hitting.
No, I doubt that, because I know he's a good shot. So
May's the one where you have like a couple guys go. You'll be like, is this sighted? I don't know. Let's see. And you shoot nothing. Here, you take it. Okay, he shoots nothing. And you're like, I don't know. We either need to adjust this or something. Hey, May, try it out. Ping, 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 ping. Okay, nope, never mind. It's us. So, yeah, it's so funny because she was talking to me and she's like, yeah, I was doing this and that and the other. And I was just like, yeah, we won't have any of that because it's all going to be either iron sights or terrible optics from the turn of the century. And she's like, oh, well, now I'm disappointed.
Honestly, I kind of wish we had brought something out that I could have tested it with, because that would have been fun to even just lay there for a few hours and just give that a try.
Oh, just iron sights?
Yeah, and just kind of work that in. That would have been fantastic with someone like a nice spotter to kind of give me a hand, which, I mean, hopefully someone would have been willing to do that, but that would have taken me some time.
So the loose plan right now is we've been offered a Lee Enfield Mark III with sights.
Right.
We've been offered a... P14 with sights, with glass, I should say, this whole time. Sorry, just go. My terminology is falling apart. I'm too tired today. So we've been offered a scoped P14 and scoped Mark III. I'm not sure about the P14's period. I gotta go do some research, as to what was available. I have not sat down and done my sniper research. Everybody thinks I know everything at once, and I really don't. I only know it by... I know it... for about a year after I do the episode, and then even then it starts to fade because I start working on something else and I can only store so much.
Right.
So I have to go build a sort of cache. I have a bunch of sideline notes to sort of amalgamate sniper history in World War I. So we've been offered those two, and then more recently, finally, what I was really hoping for is someone offered up a Gewehr 98 that's been scoped. So we have in-house a scoped... Springfield 1903.
Yes.
But it's just a barreled action and the Warner Swayze. And we got a screaming deal on it, but we have to go clean it up, restock it, make sure it's accurized, bedded. Like, we've got to do a lot of work to get that gun where it needs to be. And then I have a lot of research to do. So there will be a sniper episode. The assets are floating in the ether with people willing to help out. What I suspect is that we'll probably end up taking a trip to, I would say, Texas.
Yes.
Unless something changes. Because we have friends out there who run Nine Hole Reviews, and they have access to long range, and they have long range experience. And so what we'll probably do is borrow Henry, and then you can give, obviously, an opinion of going through some, essentially, sniper training, because Henry can shoot a lot better than we can long range. So what we'll do is we'll just have two shooters and get a strong opinion on these and make some sort of collaborative project out of it.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
So I love their videos. They do such good visuals.
Oh, fantastic. Like, again, one of those people that takes a lot of time to show you and tell you what's happening visually.
Yes.
As I say, making a radio show. let me check our time. Wow, we are almost an hour of talking.
So. Well, to be fair, it's pretty good. We're giving some good content.
I hope. I think we're just rambling into the darkness. I hope we're not driving everybody crazy. So, the one thing from our trip that we haven't discussed, though, and by the way, there's a lot of guys I gotta say thanks to. I saw my buddy Cal from Optics Planet and stuff like that. There's a bunch of shout-outs, like my buddy Florian, who comes in from Germany. He's supposed to come down here and do some motorcycling with me. Yeah, that'd be nice. But there's just... I haven't named like 30 people, and I'm sorry, but there's a lot going on there, and the stories will leak out here and there as we remember them.
Yes.
But the big event is that I just damn near totaled our car because it was all Georgia mud, so hybrid red clay Frankenstein stuff. And
by rain for that whole first day, we mean it did not let up. It started at, what, like 6 a.m. and it ended at like...
10 p.m.
10 p.m. maybe.
And it just, yeah. And so everything was mud. It was all dirt roads turned to mud. We have the Suburban. It's like a 2004 with four-wheel drive.
Yes.
And the four-wheel drive does great. It's fine.
Oh, it did awesome.
So I was driving around a four-wheel high the whole day, essentially just trying to keep from getting stuck. And taking it, by the way, I know how to drive in mud. You don't see me spinning my wheels. You know what I mean? And we were done for the day. We were about to go back to the hotel and get washed, and then go back out and see Brownells for a party, and some of the other guys were doing stuff.
And I'm so happy that we thought, oh no, we need to say bye to Kevin because he's about to head out. I'm so glad we did that.
Yeah, so we go over to the campsites to say goodbye to Kevin, and I roll up to where Kevin's at, and I see him. I'm like, oh good. So I start putting my brakes on. And I'm stopping, all of a sudden I kind of clunk to a stop.
And you maybe been going like 2 miles an hour at that point.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, I hit a log in the mud or something. Like, not a log, but a branch.
Yeah, something. And you get
to
back up.
Yeah, so it was like I backed off of it. And then I kind of thought for a second, I went, yeah, that was kind of a hard clunk. So I went to put it back in drive just to see if I could roll. Like, something made me nervous. I'm always nervous around four-wheel drives. I blew up a transfer case when I was in high school. So I go to drive forward and I make it a couple inches and clunk. And I went, maybe there's still something in the mud here. So I back it way up off the other side of the road and then put it in drive and I go forward a couple inches and then clunk. I was like, what is going on? So I think I've got a broken off tooth or
effectively you can go backwards fine, just can't go forwards.
I couldn't figure it out because if it was a transmission failure, I should have been able to put it in drive and have nothing. You know what I mean? In transfer case, you expect some sort of grind. Something was wrong about the whole thing.
Right.
And so everybody's getting out of the car, looking around the car, trying to figure out where it's coming from, where they can hear it, whatever else. And I'm going forward and back, and this is where I screwed myself, because I'm going forward and back over and over and over again. Because
we're trying to sort it out. We're trying to figure out exactly where it's coming from.
Right.
But you're not going fast. You're just gentle tapping.
Well, it's a big, heavy car.
Yeah.
So, for all of you who are now in suspense, what had happened is the right rear, and I have a mechanic to talk to tomorrow, because we just got back last night, and I'm taking it a little easy today. The right rear brake caliper... we had the rear calipers redone by a mechanic instead of by myself, which I always hate doing, but I don't have the time to do all my own work anymore. They did not torque down the upper bolt tight enough, and the upper bolt on the caliper let go, and the caliper fell forward.
into the wheel well.
Yeah. Oh, not into the wheel well, but into the inside of the rim.
Yeah.
And so if you rolled backwards, it just slid. But if you roll forward, it would bite and punch into the rim.
Yep.
And in testing, I managed to punch several holes through my rim all the way around the rim.
And then you had a nice, pristine little ground, like, ring around the inside from where it was dragging when you went backwards.
Yep. And so it punched holes through the rim, and we lost air. So at that moment, it's like 8 o'clock at night. And so we had David and Kristen with us, luckily. So they ran out to the auto store, who had the incorrect hours listed.
Yep.
So then they had to run out to the next auto store, which is across the border in Bama. So they actually did probably like an hour and 45-minute round trip for us.
Yep.
Thank you, David and Kristen.
Yes, thank you both for that.
While May and I were in the freezing rain.
With Bruno, yeah.
By the way, I want to point out, we had gotten soaked the whole day, and now it's getting cold out and still raining. And so we're, like, freezing soaked, and I'm still just getting the... Because we knew we needed the bolt, the caliper's fine, so we sent David out. So Kevin's helping us out. We have to... We're in the mud, so we have to go find a bunch of wood, get everything set up, bottle jacket up. The way the clearances were, we had to bottle jacket up, put a jack stand under it, take the bottle jack down, thread out the head, bottle jacket even further up, and then to get it back down, same thing. So we're doing all this extra stuff just to do basic crap because of all this mud. And then we get the old tire off, we get the caliper hung, pull the bolts, we get David comes back with two, you know, Loctited, fresh, threaded bolts.
Yes.
We set those all in, and it's like a jack stand, a bottle jack, and an 18mm wrench, and we were done in terms of what needed to happen. But it took hours just waiting on the part to go back and forth in the freezing cold. And then I don't know why, but the thing that irritates the crap out of me more than anything else is that Chevy spare tire that drops from the cable underneath the car.
Yeah, that's funny. That's the thing that irritates you the most out of all this.
I don't know why. As a design person, it irritates the royal crud out of me. But the spare tire drops down, and then there's a collar that you free and turn sideways, and then it goes through the center of the hub.
And drops it from underneath the car. Right. Yeah.
So I go to put up the damaged rim under the car.
Which has the factory rims on
it. It's the same diameter hole for the hub and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, yeah, I'll just shove this thing. No, it's set up so that you can't clear it. So that you could hang a spare tire, but an actual regular rim can't be hung under there. So I then had to make room in the car for the entire tire and rim, because the tire's still good. It's just the rim is gone.
Yes, it is not.
But I don't know why, but it's just the engineer in me just hated it. I was like, after all this I went through, someone was too lazy to make this thing in such a way that I could hang the factory rim back under here so that I don't have to have a dirty, horrible tire in my car.
Yep.
Sorry. I know it's... some of you know this pain and know exactly what I'm talking about when I'm frustrated by that. But we got back on the road. We had a full-size spare, and before we left for Wyoming, I had already... That was just, you know, 2 months ago. I had pulled and checked the spare. I don't go out of town without checking the spare.
Right.
So...
And I'm amazed. So we had those calipers put on before we left for Wyoming, too. So we went to Wyoming
I got to go check the mileage, but there's a few thousand miles on those on that setup, but they must not have torqued it down correctly, because I don't see how it could have worked itself all the way loose. The one had to work itself loose from the top, and then the bottom one obviously just got rolled over. I don't know if it was loose or not to begin with. I don't know if it, because you think about it, when it rolls forward, it would loosen the bolt.
Yeah.
So the bolt was loose. It was hand loose on the lower bolt when I got in there. But that could be because it loosened itself when it rolled forward because of applying the brakes while rolling.
Yeah.
That was just the biggest nightmare. Like, just... Luckily, I thought I had blown the transfer case or something. I was so livid.
Luckily, y'all got it sorted, and it's the tire's on there, and we managed to make it home.
No, it was funny. It was very weird, because like, when I saw that the rim was gouged, and there was air leaking out of the rim, and the caliper was all, you know, messed up, the first thing I said, I was looking at Kevin, I was like, I'm so happy right now. And he was just like, you know, a weird way of being happy. And I was like, you don't understand. I know what this problem is, and it is a problem that can be resolved within the time it takes for me to leave this town. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I can leave tomorrow on time. Even if the bolt's not here right now, I can drive somewhere. Like, I got a guy with a car that's a friend of mine. We can go as far as we need to get the part. It will all be solved within the next 12 hours. Like, I'm exhausted and wet and freezing and all these other things, but my problem is solvable within 12 hours. And it ended up being solved inside of 4.
Yeah.
But solvable within 12 hours is like the best I can ask for in my life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, I'm not, nobody's dead, and I can solve this in under 12 hours.
Hooray.
Hooray. This is called the best Tuesday ever, you know? But, okay, what else? Give me a positive one to end on. What was your favorite thing about this whole trip?
Probably getting to hang out with Kevin the whole time.
That's true. Kevin's a doll baby.
Yeah, it was great to, honestly.
That's not true, though, because you hung out with your other best friend.
Oh, I love Jeremy. Jeremy from WLS, like, he's...
Yeah, so if you guys watch or listen to, I should say, we like shooting.
I miss Sean. Like, Sean was doing a bunch of stuff, so, like, I missed him, but I got to hang out with Jeremy a good bit up on the 1,000-yard range. Like, that was fun.
Yeah. May and Jeremy are good friends because they're both poorly behaved and shoot a lot of guns.
Yeah. We're just good buddies. We just had the same wavelength of dumb.
That's fair.
And awesome.
I only saw Chad briefly. I barely saw Eric because, of course, they were running the event.
Oh, yeah. So they were busy.
Like, that was a huge mess to be in charge of.
I liked hanging out with Roy. Smoked some tobacco. That was nice.
Yep. We hung out with Such a bit. Such was at the same hotel as us, so we just had breakfast with him and stuff. Like,
yeah.
Nice dude to hang out with.
Yeah.
But
I think it was the people. I think it was, honestly, the people I got to meet that were good friends and the people I got introduced to, because everyone at the event was very accommodating and being like, yeah, you can shoot whatever I've got. And they would just hand us guns. Like, and it's never like they've not been like that before. But honestly, the first time I went to the event, I was a little bit timid and felt a little bit nervous about just asking people to, you know, be able to shoot all their stuff. But at this one, nope, just went up and was like, that looks interesting. Can I try this? Or I don't know how to work the sight on this. Can you explain it to me? Like, things like that. It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, they really were great.
I love it. It's, you know, it's always... I always had the best time with people who can smile in a bad situation.
Yeah.
It's kind of like what I was saying about the tire. It's like, I can solve this in 12 hours. Like, the people who are just like, yep, I put on my rain jacket, and then I get to work. Like, mm-hmm. There are people that were willing to march. There are people that were willing to get out and talk to each other and try things even in the rain. And they brought a smile when they did it because they wanted to set the tone, you know? And those are the people that I get along with best. Like, we were out in the rain screwing around with the shotguns. Like, we weren't going to let it hold us down.
Nope. And it was a blast. It really was.
Yeah. Super fun for some. Some people were very deeply irritated.
And
a lot of people
Let it dampen our spirits.
I think the guys who stuck around for day two had a lot better of a time. Because
they absolutely did.
Everybody that was there for day two was determined to have a good time.
Well, I think also, like, everyone didn't have to move tents very often. Like, they got to stay under what tent they were under, too. I think that made it a little bit easier. So they didn't even have to traverse the mud
that often. I saw more people going back and forth.
Okay.
But to be fair, things tightened up because there were fewer vendors and stuff. A lot of people booked it early.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, Brownells was still out there. Had a great time. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of fun to be had the second day by just sort of being around the people who were determined to make it fun. And
yes.
The attitude changed a lot.
It did.
And so,
I think it's because basically the people that made it through the first day and they were like, oh no, I'm going to be there for the second day. They were determined to make it a better day.
Yeah.
So they did.
I like it. I love those kind of people.
Yeah. It was great.
But, I mean, I don't want to say that people who didn't go weren't that way. Some people A lot of it, a lot of people, rental cars.
Yes.
In that mud.
They had to make some people had to make some unfortunate calls and not go back because they didn't want to incur any further damage to their rentals.
There's a lot of people running to car washes before they took their car back to get on the plane to go to the airport.
Yep.
So I don't want to blame anybody for not being there. But I am saying the ones that stuck around were in it to win it.
Yes.
So... I don't know. I had a great time.
So did I.
I'm glad they hosted it. I'm glad I made the time for it, although it did shred our schedule pretty
good. Yep, so we're going to be a little bit busy again. But that's okay. We'll get up there.
The short answer is we're going to try not to travel as much as possible. There is a November 2nd event that's coming up in D.C.
Yes.
And there's a lot of opinions swirling around, and we are not a political show. A lot of people I know are going. So I have basically said I'm putting it into the hands of the motorcycle gods, and I'm just going to go pull the carburetor on my Valkyrie that needs to be rejetted. I could never, that bike ran wet, just wet. And I turned the idle mixture screws all the way down, and it still runs, it still smells like gasoline and runs wet. So I'm pretty sure the previous owner did like a needle and jet job. And so I'm going to go back in and put it back to factory jets and needles and see if I can get out of it.
But that's like a solid, like, 4 to 6 hour job right there.
It's like a motorcycle that gets 10 miles to the gallon right now. It smells like gasoline. That is not a good setup. So if I can, if I pull that carburetor and get it back together in one evening, and it runs, that's my message that I have enough time to get up to DC and back.
Yep.
But if I don't, then there's no way I'm going to be able to have time to get there and back and do other things that I need to do just for myself and for the show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my loose plan for DC. And I think that's about it, right?
Yeah, that's all we got for now, I think, for updates.
Oh, no, I have a Crozier update. I'm sorry. While we were away, Susie...
It's a good update.
Yeah. So Susie decided to give Crozier some hangout time. So she put a towel down on the bed. And then she laid down next to Crozier on her side. And Crozier, being the demanding guinea pig he is, spent all of 2 minutes enjoying towel wanderings, and then came over to her and apparently climbed up, like, across her chest up onto what would be her left shoulder at that point, high in the air. And this was not good enough, because shoulders are hard and unyielding and not very warm. And she's wearing a hoodie, apparently. This is all, I'm telling the story secondhand, but this was all related to me, with extreme joy. So he stood up on her shoulder and yelled in her face at her until she rolled onto her back so that he could then climb into her hoodie and curl up essentially on top of her breast and fall asleep. That was the only way that he was going to quiet down, was to, for her to be a sleeping platform. So the demanding, violent guinea pig got his way again. Alright, so if that doesn't warm your heart, I don't know what does.
Oh,
so.
I did forget, I did want to mention, thank you, one more thing. Thank you, Sven and his wife, we definitely appreciated meeting you guys. Yeah, he got chocolate, and I got a dino egg.
Yeah, we're friends with Sven over at Manticore Arms, and so they decided to support Dino Tales by getting May a giant chocolate egg.
Well, it's not a chocolate egg, it's one of those grow eggs, but it takes like 24 to 48 hours to grow it. I'm still growing it right now.
Wait, is there one of those slippery, weird dinosaur things in there? Oh, gross.
Yeah, it's going to sit in the kitchen for now. Oh, no, wait, I can't leave it in the kitchen. I'll put it somewhere.
You're not going to pay attention. I'm going to slide it down the back of your shirt.
No. Gross.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Bye, guys.